Hi there, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. This is SensiDave82, and my website is theworldwasmeanttobefree.com. And I recently had the privilege of speaking with Dr. Joseph P. Farrell. For those of you who are not aware of his work or who he is, I highly recommend that you go to his website, which is GizaDeathStar.com, where you'll find a wealth of information on various alternative topics. You should also run over and check out his YouTube channel, which is Joseph Farrell 1, the number 1, all one word. And Dr. Farrell has a doctorate in patristics from the University of Oxford. He pursues deep research into the areas of physics, alternative history, science, alchemy, religion, the elite power structure, strange phenomena, and much more. Now, I'd originally intended for this interview to be a video recording, but it ended up that we had some interference with Skype during the conversation. Surprise, surprise. So it'll be an audio format only. And it was a great conversation, actually. We covered a lot of different subjects. We talked about the education, financial, and political systems. We talked about alternative history, physics, alchemy. We even got into the moon, anomalies, the solar system, and the transhumanist agenda, which was very, very interesting, and I highly recommend you check out his work on that. He just had a book come out, which I believe he co-authored with Dr. DeHart, who is his colleague, and I definitely recommend checking out his work on that. But pretty much any book that you pick up that he's written will definitely blow your mind and give you a lot of information that you can add to your research if you're just trying to figure out what's going on this planet. And I highly recommend his work. So head over to his website. I hope you enjoy the discussion. If you find some value in it, please share it. And thank you again for listening. Okay, there we go. That should be good now. My apologies. All right, so you were just saying about you have a follow-up to Babylon's Banksters, which is actually the first book of yours that I read. And
oh, really?
I must say, yeah, I know you've written, like, I want to get to all the books that you've written, but you've written so many amazing different, really just dots, if you think about it, right? Like, you're really trying to connect a lot of different things together and get people a really big picture, which is what I really admire about your work. And I've mostly learned about your work through various interviews that I've been listening to or watching. I think the first interview I watched was the one you did with Project Camelot a couple years back, which really impressed me. And I've just heard, you know, you're highly recommended from so many different sources. I recently did an interview with Santos Bonacci in Australia, and he highly recommended your work as well. So I've actually been reading two books simultaneously of yours, which was the Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, and the Babylon's Banksters. And after listening to some of your interviews, I've realized that I've got to go right back, start from the beginning, and try to get it all chronological. So,
well, have fun.
Yeah, no, for sure. But, you know, I've been watching also your updates. You do the News from the Nefarium, which I've been finding very enlightening, and I really appreciate them.
Thank
because
you.
You're putting so much context into history, origins, a lot of the anomalous phenomena that, you know, we experience or different people experience. You get into so many things, but then you get into, you know, what's going on currently in the political realm, what's going along financial system, what's going on in various parts of the world, which any serious researcher, as I'm sure you would agree, should never stop their research. And I feel like maybe sometimes when you read researchers, they tend to kind of have their theory and then they stop and they don't let it evolve, they don't let it grow, and then they just become one-dimensional, whereas you're someone like yourself, like, you're constantly evolving and growing and researching more and picking new topics to weave into the whole story. And so that was what really turned me on to your work. So I wondered if you wanted to talk about that a little bit.
Well, talk about what?
Just basically what drove you to, let's go from the beginning. What kind of put you on the, I guess, alternative track, and what drove you to question the original or the official stories?
Well, that was precisely it. I used to be a college professor, and one of the things I found very frustrating was you're in a culture, you're in a climate, a bureaucratic culture, which to question certain very basic assumptions is just anathema. And I always felt constrained by that. And at one point in my college teaching, I actually lost my job. There was a change of administrators. I lost my job. And at that point, I just got basically fed up with the American Academy, because in my view, it has always been fraudulent. It's been fraudulent for a long time. The standards are very poor. And it's also, to a certain degree, it's also particularly in the so-called soft disciplines like history, sociology, so on and so forth. It's one of these situations where they attempt to indoctrinate you. You know, this is your answers that you must spit out. Let me give you an example. If you were to take a so-called standardized test, an SAT, an ACT, and they were to ask you the question, who killed President Kennedy? All right, and then they'd give you, you know, they'd give you four or five multiple choice answers, one of which, of course, would be Lee Harvey Oswald. But you would not see on that question an answer suggesting that some people would argue that it was a conspiracy of some sort, be it the mafia, the CIA, military-industrial complex, bankers, or so on. Now, the problem here is, anybody with half of a non-American Academy lobotomized brain will be able to tell you that the research that has been done since the Kennedy assassination, beginning with people like Harold Weisberg, you know, that most people don't even remember, that challenged the whole basis of the Warren Report on the basis of the Warren Commission's own evidence.
Exactly. Okay? Yeah, exactly.
Will fairly convince you that there is a reasonable prima facie case to be made that there was some sort of conspiracy, or if you prefer Professor Peter Dale Scott's term, deep state involvement with the assassination of President Kennedy. Well, all right, here you have these multiple choice standardized tests, and what they're doing is they're giving you pre-selected answers, and those tests therefore serve as gauges of your ability to conform and spit out the answers of the official paradigm, the official history, the matrix that they want you to believe.
Yeah.
Well, I got started writing these books because I just determined when I lost my job that I wasn't going to attempt to go on in the American Academy, because, quite frankly, it was great big heaping steaming piles of horse pucky in many cases.
Well said. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, don't hold back, Joseph. Tell us what
no,
you really
No, don't
think,
hold back. It's no different here in Canada, so...
Yeah.
Okay. It's the same thing.
So... Yeah, you guys are getting the trickle down.
Yeah, exactly. What goes around comes around.
What's going on down here?
Yeah,
you know,
I know
whatever
exactly.
Whatever that may be, but anyway, I just decided that, and I was encouraged by a professor friend of mine that I had team taught a couple of courses with to start writing some of my theories, you know, about things very openly. And I had a very close friend at the time that encouraged me to do the same thing, and that's how Giza Death Star came about. And I do have to say that I did have it intentionally in mind that if that book showed the remotest signs of interest in the reading public, I had planned a kind of a pre-planned series of books that I wanted to spin out of that book. I already knew that if that book took off, I would write a trilogy about it. I wanted to do something with the Nazis, because again, you know, as a history professor dealing with World War II and what American textbooks tell you about World War II, you know, the United States came in the war, rah, 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 we won, you know, nobody else did anything, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, there were no Canadians at D-Day, you know.
Yeah.
There were no Russians involved, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just got fed up with that attitude, so I decided I would do something with the Nazis, because that's such a crucial component of where we're at today. So I hope that answers your question, how I got started. That basically is it in a nutshell.
Wow. And you also, you were like, if you wanted to just quickly, briefly give some of your academic background, I mean, you've done research, you've done work in physics. I believe you have a degree in physics as well.
No, oh, that's not true. That actually is something that my publisher, I'll tell you how that came about. I was on the phone. He asked me about what's your background. I said, my background is patristics, although I like, you know, physics has always been a hobby of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that okay. got translated into his mind as, okay, this guy's got an background in physics. And it took me two or three books to convince him that, no, that's not my background. It's patristics. Patristics, you know, that's the study of the early church fathers up to about the year 1500. So you have to have a lot of philosophy. You have to have a lot of languages, philosophy of science, cosmology, metaphysics, law, certainly history.
Wow.
So it's kind of a broad degree. You're basically dealing with the history of Western European culture with that degree and dealing with its primary sources. So that's my background. I have absolutely no claim to, and I want to be very clear about this, no claim to any sort of academic credentials in physics. It's a hobby of mine, and that's it.
Mm.
And, you know, I tell people all the time, I'm just a hack from South Dakota.
But most people would argue that it could be misconstrued that you do have a background in it because of how eloquent you are in that field and how knowledgeable you are. So, I mean, at least it's kind of, maybe it's a good thing that you did that sort of research on your own as a more of a maverick researcher, as opposed to just going through that typical academic structure. Maybe that is what benefited you.
It has its advantages and it has its disadvantages.
Mm-hmm.
Advantages that, of course, you're not put into the cookie cutter mold and told this is the way things are, this is what you must believe and think.
Yeah.
You're free to question certain assumptions within the development, the historical development of modern physics. And that development, I would say, really begins with Faraday and then extends through Maxwell and on up through Einstein and so on.
Mm.
That channel has led to the elaboration of what physicists call the standard model. But it has its disadvantages. The disadvantage is that you're not in a position to look at that model from the standpoint of being academically informed about it. And I'm old school academically. I believe it's critically important for people to be exposed in the lecture room with the development of a discipline from a professor of that discipline. So, mm-hmm. you know, you're at a disadvantage in that way.
I see, yeah.
But you know, where do you find traditional academic professors anymore?
Exactly.
That's gripe.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Wow. So, I mean, so you've really... And so... With the books that you started with the Giza Death Star, and that turned into three books. Or no, that was the Cosmic War that kind of, it led into the Cosmic War series and everything else, correct?
I'll tell you what I do. I plan out about three or four books ahead of where I'm writing. So in other words, there is a deliberate order in the way that my books are sequenced. And in saying that, I don't mean that people can't pick one book up in... out of order, so mm-hmm. to speak, read it with profit. They're meant to stand alone, but anyone who has read them will tell you that they're deliberately connected to the other books. Mm-hmm. All right, so you can read them in any order and get profit out of them in any order that you want, but I intentionally wrote them in a particular order. The order began with the Giza Death Star, and then I started in the third book writing about the development of Nazi science, and that for a reason, because I think some of the things that the Nazis were up to in terms of the technology, the science they were trying to develop, has analogs with what I'm seeing may have existed in very, very ancient times.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the reason those books are sequenced in that very odd way. First we have pyramids, then Nazis, and we go back to pyramid, then more Nazis, and we have Cosmic War, Nazis.
I love it. But, you know, I personally feel through what I've been able to research on my own and from listening to various other scholars and whatnot is that, you know, all of this stuff does related does have an origin, and I think the Nazis are a great thing to keep referencing, because that was a very unique thing in history, in that, you know, and you go into this extensively, that there was a very occult aspect to what the Nazis were into. The research that they were doing, they were very fanatical in their, I guess, their mindset about uncovering what the ancients knew and finding those secret technologies and hidden knowledges. And it's almost very similar to what maybe a lot of these secret orders and societies and fraternities throughout history have been trying to do. I mean, think of people like the Knights Templars and, you know, going through some of those groups. So, and the fact that the Nazis actually gained the amount of power they did in the short period of time that they did, you know, always being one step ahead, always having that, you know, within 6 years, you know, he brings Germany from being in complete depression to being a dominant military force. So, of course, that's a fascinating link into the ancients and maybe what happened to them, right?
Well, yeah, I think so. My basic model, the keystone in all of the arch of my books is precisely the book Cosmic War. I deliberately intended that book to be the keystone in the arch holding the whole structure together. So you're right to point out that book, and it's part of my assumption, it's part of my model that, and I use World War II as the example, I use World War I as the example. At the end of these tremendous conflicts, what do you have? Well, you have basically, particularly at the end of World War II, you have the European infrastructure just absolutely gutted, and even more so in Russia. You know, the Wehrmacht just literally blew the daylights out of Russia for the years that war took place. So what you have is a situation of two surviving elites. You have the good guys, you know, the allied Anglo-American surviving financial oligarchy, and then you have that European central fascist international, is what I call it, or the Nazi international, that survives the war and deliberately intended to survive the war and deliberately intended not just to survive in little enclaves clinging to bare life and existence, you know, under threat from the Mossad. But literally becoming a major covert force in post-war geopolitics and research. And that's what they did. So, you know, that's my model. And I take that model and I project it backwards and say, well, all right, if we've got a sophisticated civilization that existed in prehistoric times, that was the seeding civilization to the classical cultures of the Indus Valley or Sumer or Egypt, and they themselves, this is an important part of the story, they themselves speak of themselves as legacy civilizations. In other words, they're telling you right there that, hey, we come from somewhere else, we come from somebody else.
Yeah.
And they'll tell you that civilization was much higher, much more sophisticated. Well, that's my working model, that there was such a civilization, that it was probably interplanetary. That may sound kooky, but... That's what I think the texts indicate. That's what I think some of the anomalous evidences on nearby celestial neighbors indicates, and that civilization blew itself apart in a war. Well, what do you have when you have that sort of situation? You're going to have surviving elites again, and the texts themselves tell you this.
That's right.
And what do those elites do? They take an inventory of the technology. What do we need to survive? How are we going to survive? And that's what they set out to do. So, you know, this is why I've mixed up the books like this, because what I'm really trying to do is get people to see themes, to see connections in a very different way. That used to be the way that academia functioned, you know, but now we're just taught, well, you connect these dots, but not those dots. Fill in with your number two lead pencil these bubbles, but not those bubbles.
It's true. It's so true. And, you know, you're pointing out a lot of things that would shatter the very mainstream perspective that we've been handed down in the official histories, and we've sort of gotten an authorized history. Like, it's been somebody has taken it and said, this is approved for the masses, so that way, you know, we can produce the sort of working class mentality that we want, and then also to not inspire them to look into their origins. Because one thing I wanted to kind of get into a little bit with you, Joseph, is kind of having the basic theme in mind, which is all these the big questions, you know. It's kind of the theme of my website, where we're just trying to ask those questions and keep them in mind in all the research, which is, you know, who are we, where did we come from, and why are things the way they are as opposed to something different? Why haven't we achieved peace and prosperity on the planet? Why is there constant state of war and chaos? And I know you know exactly where I'm going with this. So, I mean, it's when you're looking at the topics that you're researching and you're connecting all these dots together, I think people are being taught to look at things in isolation only. So you become maybe a specialist in one area, but then you're not really... you're not drawing
divide in... Divide and hide is
well, exactly.
It's the name of the academic technique employed here. Exactly. You know, divide it into this specialty and that specialty, and don't connect any dots. You know, that's the opposite of what a liberal education, what an academic education was supposed to be. It was supposed to be to enable you to connect dots.
That's
they don't want that anymore. But I, you know, in answer to part of your question, and I know I cut you off, but I wanted to point out something very significant for people. There is in America something called the American Historical Society. And if you research this thing, this is sort of the entity that is responsible for putting out the official line. And they have big name academics and so on. But what you really find is you find lots of big foundation backing of this society. In other words, think of certain families whose last names begin with R.
I think I saw that coming. That's good.
Yeah. You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And my point here is you have official lines being put out in almost every discipline. And the way that you break the official line is, first of all, you throw out the American or Canadian textbook for a very simple reason. The American or Canadian textbook contains no texts. They will tell you what somebody thinks Plato said rather than give you a text of Plato to read. So in other words, you know, throw out the textbook and read the texts. Read Plato, read Aristotle, read Aquinas, read Iamblichus, read, you know, read James Clerk Maxwell, read Michael Faraday, read Albert Einstein, read the papers that made each discipline, particularly the sciences, what they are now, rather than what someone tells you they said.
Exactly.
Once you start doing that, then you're going to start connecting the dots, and you're going to be able to see through what people want you to think and feel and believe about each of these subject areas. And then you start connecting the dots on your own, and that's critical. I mean, we've all got to start doing that. Anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I just wanted to put that out there because it's very important.
Oh, and you know what? It's exactly what I was looking to get into as well, because like, I work with a lot of kids. I teach at a martial arts school, and that's actually my profession. And I work with a lot of young kids, and I see their, you know, the ability or the lack of ability to even just stay focused for 5 minutes, let alone, I mean, and of course, kids are kids. But what I find interesting is that what I try to do is just ask them a lot of questions and just keep it open-ended and get them to think of the answer themselves instead of just repeating what I've said. And even if it contradicts what I've taught them, at least I'm trying to get them to react and get the right brain going a little bit and be creative with their responses. And, you know, it starts at you know, elementary level school and goes all the way up, you know, high school, then into the universities. And these universities and these sort of elite institutions and organizations, they tend to take the role, they walk around as though they are the ones that have what's true, they have all the facts, they have all the evidence, and anybody contradicting what they're saying is just a kook. So they have this outsider thing where they condemn people to the outside, we don't want to hear that. And then what happens is that the young people that are growing up that organically would want to learn the answers to some of these questions or might have a really deep desire to gain knowledge, it gets sapped out of them because of that whole memorize-repeat process.
Right.
So there's going to be very few Dr. Joseph Farrells that are going to be out there in the future that are going to go outside of the box and do their own research. And I guess to me, that's a scary future for me, because we're not looking at a youth that's growing up empowered with knowledge, right?
No, we're not. We're looking at Canada and the United States becoming third world nations in less than a century, given the academic standards that are taking place in our two countries. That's exactly what we're looking at. Yeah. You know, I get young people asking me all the time, should I go to college? And I always tell them, for what?
Yeah.
For what? To spend tens of thousands of dollars on a degree that will pay you less than that per year for jobs that no longer exist because they've shipped them all overseas. What are you going to do? Well, I want an education. Well, okay, then read. There's your education. You don't need a slip of paper from some, you know, degree mill telling you that you're educated. You know, the reason I went to Oxford is that it is a European university in the fullest sense of the word. You are left entirely and totally on your own. Mm. And you don't major in a course. You're not ticked off in a roll call book that you were here on such and such a day to attend Professor so-and-so boring lecture and book report on topic A of the day. You are expected to go out and read in your subject matter, and they don't care if you show up to lectures or not. All you have to do is satisfy them that you know your subject matter, all right? Yeah. And they'll grill you. And if you pass, you pass, and if you fail, too bad. You know, they don't care.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, you know, to me, that's a responsible way of education. And that's particularly at the collegiate and graduate level, that's what it should be. We don't have that in this country anymore. We have, as you said, we have indoctrination mills where you're told what to think rather than how to think.
That's right, yeah.
And you know, the key here is indicated in what the degree of a PhD actually says. A PhD means doctor of the philosophy of something. In other words, it's telling you that they're supposed to be able to show you at a deep structure level how a particular discipline works and thinks. Mm-hmm. And they don't do that anymore. It's all regurgitation of standard models. You know, there are physics students, David, coming out of our colleges now. There are physics students that are taught four partial differential equations as being Maxwell's equations of electromagnetism. Hmm. And they're even repeated in the popular physics books of a famous theoretical physicist teaching at Columbia University, whose name I won't mention, all right? But he wrote several, you know, a Japanese-American fellow, whose physics textbooks and physics popularization books repeat this same error. And I am not ashamed to say it's an error, because the equations you're looking at are not Maxwell's equations at all. They're the edited equations of the British physicist Oliver Heaviside, who said, oh, we can't have these things in Maxwell's equations because they lead to certain things that we don't like. And Heaviside even comes out and tells you, I am going to murder, and that's his word, murder, this scalar potential idea.
Wow.
So he recasts Maxwell's equations from a mathematical language called quaternion geometry to the partial differential form that you read and use today. So physicists are coming out of college and told one thing which is totally untrue. They're not dealing with Maxwell's equations at all. They're dealing with Oliver Heaviside's equation.
Oh, wow.
And that has had a profound effect on the development of physics. So again, if you want to know a subject, read the history of the subject from the primary sources.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need a piece of paper from XYZ University to tell you that you know a subject. That's what you got to do.
Well, and unfortunately, a lot of people, like you were saying, they just want to get that paper so they can have the letters beside their name or whatever, and then hopefully go and apply and get a job. But like you said, based on the state of things now, there's no jobs.
That's it. Higher education has become a license to practice a job.
Yes.
Rather than a certification of a certain attainment of expertise within a discipline. Mm. And therefore, when you adopt the philosophy that higher education is a license to practice, then you've lost the idea of what a higher education is for.
Yeah.
And therefore, you don't carry that spirit forward with you in life. You know, just because you have a degree doesn't mean you quit reading. I mean, you know.
Exactly.
I have more books now than I ever had in college. And, you know, people ask me, well, when are you going to quit buying all these books? Well, probably when I croak.
Yeah, exactly. Well, because you love knowledge. And, I mean, I feel the same way. And I have a library of books. And I talk to people that are, you know, teachers, or they're in school, they're in university, whatever. And we have conversations. And it's, you know, I've done the same thing where I've basically sort of self-educated. I've gone out and whatever I'm curious about learning, I'll try to find who are the experts in that field, what are the different theories and philosophies, and then make my own decision after hearing them all out. Like, you're not, that's the one thing that people aren't taught anymore, which is to get in, you know, where does your own intuition come into play? Where does your own conscious mind and your own decision making? I mean, most people are basically just other people. They're just repeating, you know, whether it's from school, because, I mean, taking this from education into, say, where we've got the mass of the population being informed on what's going on in the world by the mass media, which is only owned by a small handful of people again. Some of them have the same last name starting with the letter R. and you know, and then we all are dealing with the financial system, the same financial system, and we're taught about that by the media. Right. And that financial system is, again, dominated by a few people. So we're all assuming that we're right based on no research, no evidence. We're only going off of something we've been told. So I'm thinking, how are we going to deal with this problem of... with, you know, trying to educate people who feel they're already educated?
Well, I can't speak for you know, having any inside track or philosophy on how to deal with the galloping, somersaulting ignorance that we see going on in Western culture. But I do think there's two factors here. The internet is waking people up, number one. The old playbooks by the power elites are not working nearly as well as they used to a mere 10 years ago. Mm. I mean, now when these people do anything, the first thing that I see people's reaction being, oh yeah, right, you know, we've heard this before, seen this before.
Yep.
Come up with something new.
They're starting to catch on, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're starting to catch on, which finally, you know, after a couple thousand years, I would say it's about time.
Yeah, but, yeah, exactly. You
know, but the other thing I think people have to be aware of and be willing to do is precisely read and think on your own. And I used to tell my students when I was teaching, trust your own mind. Mm. Trust your own mind. Just because somebody's in front of a classroom or has PhD behind their name or is in front of a microphone on a major news channel does not mean they know what they're talking about.
Yep.
It merely means they're a sock puppet repeating what their masters have told them to say. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's okay to question. I mean, trust your own mind and understand it's okay to question. You may come up with theories that are totally kooky and nutty, but hey, that's okay. We all make mistakes.
That's right.
You know, claim the academic right to be wrong.
Exactly. And that's one thing I was going to say too is, I mean, in academics, in even the concept of free speech or what we're supposed to have free speech, I mean, I look at an example here in Canada where we had the G20 summit come here down to Toronto. And they, you know, I'm thinking, well, I've watched what happened in the previous G20 summits where you had like the Pittsburgh and the London and all with the massive brutality the police did, you know, perpetrated on those people and all that. And I thought, okay, they're coming to Canada. Well, Canada, it'll be okay. You know, we're Canada. They'll never do that here. And it turned out to be the worst one I've ever seen. And there's been three documentary, you know, probably many more than that, but three big documentary films done about it. And again, it has to do with free speech. You know, the ability to even, you know, they even had an area cordoned off called the free speech zone. So, okay, they give us a zone.
It's okay to think and say what you want here.
Here, But what was funny about it is that they still raided the zone. They still came in and arrested people. And so I just sit there and I say, okay, in the academic world, you know, you can't have your own mind. In society, you can't have your own mind. And half of that comes from even other people, friends, family, that, you know, are constantly critiquing you and trying to correct you and make sure you're not thinking too far outside the box. So they kind of, we kind of police ourselves a little bit. But then you also have the sort of powers that be, and, you know, the whole, we're seeing all in America, I've been following how much, you know, with these different NDAA acts and all these different internet privacy bills, and you can tell they're really trying to clamp down as much as they can. But do you think that enough people are waking up to not fall for it, or?
Okay, here's the problem. They're clamping down, or they're attempting to clamp down, because of the phenomenon that we just talked about. Number one, the internet is making it possible to get to deeper stories. Information is flowing faster than these elites can control it. Number two, if you look at the growing sense of, well, quite frankly, disgust at the political systems in Western countries, and I'm not thinking just of America here. You know, I'm neither a dummy crook nor a Republic thug. I abominate both of these so-called two political parties and Barmit Obromniak, you know, these two sock puppets that you can't tell a dime's worth of difference between them. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not even thinking here in America. I'm looking at Germany, for example. I'm thinking, okay, here's a relatively prosperous country, huge economy, export-driven, thrifty people, industrious people, and they don't want to bail out Europe. Okay, most Germans are just, you know, fed up. Can you blame them? Well, no, of course not. But is their government responsive to them? No. You know, you've got Chancellor and Merkel running all over Europe telling everybody how they're going to do it, you know, or otherwise, you know, Berlin's going to cut off the spigot, while at the same time she's taking nearly the whole blooming federal German government over to Beijing with her to keep the Chinese reassured.
Wow.
So in other words, the government is unresponsive. I've got several blogs coming up in the next couple of weeks about how the European Union has now sided with Monsanto over the study of French scientists on GMO corn. So in other words, these governments are totally unresponsive to the people. The reason why they're clamping down is they're afraid. Their techniques of control and information and perception management are breaking down. And they're breaking down largely because of the internet. They have pulled, in this country since the Kennedy assassination, I mean, we have been governed by scandal, crisis, and gunshot, all right, in the United States. We've had Kennedy, we've had Watergate, Iran-Contra, the BCCI scandal, the savings and loan scandal, Ruby Ridge, Waco, the Oklahoma City bombing, and 9/11, all right? So it's governance by crisis, stage-managed, false-flag crisis. And people are simply saying, look at this. Look at this. And we're spending all of these billions of dollars, and you keep passing more and more draconian laws for our protection and security, and it's not doing any good. Well, when you keep doing that, people are eventually thinking, well, therefore, it's got to be an inside job. You know, it doesn't matter if there's any evidence or not. That's just the natural reaction. So people are waking up for that reason, and that puts the power elite under a huge scheduling problem. You know, they're now on a rush where they weren't before. It's because people are waking up, and they've got geopolitical challengers on the stage, too, that are simply not going to play the one-world global governance, new world order game according to the rotten child and Rockefeller rules, all right? And you know, that's why they hate Putin. They hate that man because they cannot control him, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't think that he's particularly a nice guy, you know, but by the same token, he's not some neo-Stalinist as they're trying to portray.
That's right. Yeah, they're trying to make him out to be exactly. Yeah.
No, this isn't what he is, you know. You know, I used to teach Russian history, and I get asked this question all the time, And I've always, you know, my Russian history students will tell you that I was teaching during the collapse of the Soviet Union, and I was trying to tell my students that this is coming out of that Orthodox civilizational culture that Russia represents. Mm. It is not a, you know, it may have been Western-driven at the time with Yeltsin and you know, the Endowment for Democracy and all George Soros and all these people manipulating things behind the scenes. But you had the KGB reaction against that with Putin. And, you know, that's exactly what we have now. We've mm-hmm. got kind of a neo-Tsarist rather than a neo-Stalinist in charge in Russia. So, you know, the whole situation is to the point that these elites are simply pushing up their schedule because their position is very fragile. Mm-hmm. And they know it.
Yeah. And it's funny how it just so happens to be in this year, 2012. I mean, we've got all these different writings from, again, taking it back to the ancients, where they're talking not about the end of the world, but about the, you know, the age of revealing. I mean, the age of change and great change, the end of the old world, bringing in the new world. And they're just talking about cycles, and they're talking about maybe this is something that's repetitive in the past, or it's just they're able to.
It is. You know, you mentioned Babylon's banksters, and I talk a great deal in that book about cycles and the knowledge that banks have had of cyclical economic activity for a long time. And when you put it on the level that you've put it on, in terms of cultural, civilizational cycles. Mm. Well, we seem to go through these about once every 500 years. The last time we went through this in Western civilization was during the Protestant Reformation and the Catholic Counter-Reformation. Mm. And there was a technology, of course, that was driving that and challenging the power elite of the day, and that was the printing press.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And you know, and the hidden part of the story, I'm not going to tell you, but there was a financial oligarchy behind both sides of that conflict using the press to drive it. Mm. Right? Now, we're at a cycle, one of those 500-year period cycles, where I think you have several technologies, not just the internet, but you know, you have all of these transhumanist technologies and agendas coming online at the same time that you have a financial crisis occurring. So we're at not only a 500-year crisis, I think we're at the major turning point in human history since that cosmic war that I believe took place eons ago. I think this is a major head. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, like, you're not the only expert or researcher to say that. I mean, I've been speaking with a few different brilliant gentlemen as well that have and different people that have been reiterating the same basic structure, where we've got something that, you know, there's a lot of cycles closing now. And if you talk to somebody, like I was even talking to Santos Bonacci, and he, of course, talks a lot about astrology and astral theology and all of that. And he's going through how even in the galaxy of where we are and in the solar system and how everything's, you know, in a state of constant flux and movement, that we are reaching the end of many different cycles closing at this time as well, which, you know, so it seems like on all levels, maybe we're only witnessing the effect of everything that's going on at a higher level. Like, maybe it's happening at a higher level or a higher domain, and then we're witnessing the effects of that at a lower level.
I do believe that there's some truth to that. In Babylon's Banksters, what I was trying to begin to show was that there is an intimate and very deep relationship between the basic kind of physics that you adhere to and the types of economics that your society practices and the types of civilizational cycles that you see. Hmm. Now, in saying physics, I am not trying to get people to think that it all boils down or is a materialist reduction. In fact, I'm exactly the opposite. I'm one of those people that thinks that these hyperdimensional physics theories, in other words, theories of physical mechanics that involve more than three spatial dimensions. All right, I'm, you can only envision such things mathematically. You can only envision them in the mind. Mm. That's what these equations do. They paint pictures in the mind if you know how to decipher them. So in other words, that's a very, if you will, psychological view. It's a very spiritual view. Mm. It's not a materialistic reduction. And I think one of the things that falls out of this physics, incidentally, is that consciousness, personality, or the mind, if you will, is non-local. It's a non-local phenomenon. It's not enclosed in this
That's
body,
right.
but rather yeah. our mind, our brains transduce it, you know, from some higher dimensional physical reality. Hmm. But I think that we're getting to the point that we are seeing the beginnings of the development of a formal language, by which I mean a formally explicit kind of mathematical language that is applicable or could be applicable to several disciplines at the same time, not just physics, not just economics, not just sociological modeling, but across the board. Now, we have not been in this spiritual condition or state since the mythologies that talk about the fall or the Tower of Babel moment of history, to use Leonard Bernstein's expression for it, when humanity, regardless of which mythological tradition you look at, when humanity was in a unified state and therefore had knowledge that, if you read these traditions carefully, were threats to the gods or threats to God because of that unification. And therefore, what do we got to do? Well, you know, the biblical version is, well, we look, if he finishes this project, meaning mankind, they'll be able to do whatsoever they imagine to do. So let's go down there and scramble the tongues. Now, interestingly enough, in the biblical story, there's not any mention that what mankind is doing is sinful.
Mm.
It's a threat.
Yeah, exactly, okay. Exactly. Let's hold them back.
And let's hold them back.
Yeah.
And you know, that, which is odd, because every other time in the Bible that you see God presuming to act, it's because of some moral problem, all right, supposedly. But in this case, there's nothing in the story to suggest that. It's just, if he finishes this project, they'll be able to do whatsoever they imagine to do. Well, interestingly enough, you find the same idea of an implicit threat in the Mesopotamian versions of it, in the Mayan versions of it. You know, you find it all over. We're at that stage, I think, or beginning to be at that stage. And I think this is the other reason that the powers that be are accelerating, because they know from looking at, and I'm absolutely convinced that they look at the same ancient texts that I've been looking at, and that they're looking at them in exactly the same way, and they're seeing exactly the same technologies, they're seeing exactly the same physics. Well, if you think that having hydrogen bombs proliferate throughout the world, you know, Iran wants an atom bomb, and of course the atom bomb is a fuse to a hydrogen bomb, so, you know, in addition to France, Great Britain, Russia, the United States, and China, we could have India, Pakistan, everybody with a reactor can light up a hydrogen bomb, you know?
Yeah.
All right. Well, if you think the proliferation problem with nuclear and thermonuclear weapons is bad, just imagine turning the clock back to these ancient texts where you are seeing described a physics and technology capable, like in the Star Wars epics, of blowing up an entire planet. And imagine that technology proliferating.
Yeah.
Well, the sad fact is, I think, from looking at developments in physics and technology, I think we're at the cusp of these things getting out of the bottle. And what the elites are afraid of is, if they get out of the bottle and we don't have this world structure nailed down, we're in a heap of trouble. Because imagine a Kim Jong-un in North Korea getting a hold of it, or the mad Ayatollahs in Tehran, or the nutcase in Tel Aviv. Hmm. You know, just imagine any of these people getting a hold of this technology. Mm-hmm. Imagine it proliferating and being weaponized. That's their problem. I think this is one of the driving forces behind what's going on right now.
And just to add to that too, I mean, would it also be correct to see though that who are the real psychopaths who have actually used these weapons? Are they necessarily just concerned for humanity, or are they just themselves wanting to dominate that knowledge and dominate that technology? So, because I mean, if we look at in history, who's ever even used these weapons, aside from getting into ancient possible uses of these weapons, we're looking at, you know, United States of America being, you know, number one, and here they are, and you got, you know, people like Israel who have violated all kinds of stuff with this non-proliferation agreements. They're, you know, it's all the stuff they're doing to Palestine and their own people and whatever. Yet they're getting getting off scot-free. Yet the bad guy is Iran because they don't even have one built yet. You know, don't worry about North Korea. We're not even going to go there yet. But you know, it just seems that they're not, I guess maybe the way I view it is not that they're trying to, you know, keep this back from humanity so we don't destroy ourselves, but more so to dominate and control that technology so they can continue their control.
Exactly. I mean, it to them is one and the same thing to maintain their own hegemony and prevent the proliferation of it. It's one and the same thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, the problem of nuclear proliferation doubles or actually increases exponentially with this kind of technology. Because, you know, I've got a bunch of blogs coming up in the next couple of weeks about just kind of off-the-shelf technologies that they're trying to develop right now. You know, pinched plasma fusion engines. Well, you know, so what? Pinched plasma fusion engines. You know, we can get to Mars in 3 months instead of 8. Big deal.
Yeah.
Well, it's a big deal because if the engine works, then you can trigger a fusion reaction by simply sending enough electrical current through lithium wires. Now, stop and think what that really just told you. Hmm. It just told you that you can trigger a thermonuclear fusion reaction without an atom bomb to set it off.
Wow.
So in other words, you have a clean hydrogen bomb. No nasty fallout from the atom bomb going up into the stratosphere and raining death down on your family, you know?
Mm.
So in other words, you can light one of those things off.
It's the green bomb.
It's green.
It's megaton- green.
it's green megatonnage, folks.
Yeah.
Like that, you know, like that's a... But to the sick psychopathic mentality that you have in these major world militaries, you know, this is kind of a holy grail.
Yeah.
Well, just imagine if you have the ability to press a button like in Star Wars and blow up a planet. I think personally that my reading of the ancient texts and certain astronomical theories is, yeah, I think that happened once.
Mm-hmm.
Right here in our solar system, somebody pressed a button, blew up a planet, and now we've got the asteroid belt.
Okay? Yep.
You know, I think it happened. And the other thing, you know, you started out saying the Nazis going back and looking at ancient texts. Well, yeah, I think with Nazi Germany, you had the first real attempt in modern history, in recorded history, really, to take a technologically sophisticated great power and literally attempt to reconstruct Atlantis. I really think that the bottom line is that's what Nazi Germany was all about.
Mm.
And after the war, some nutcase, you know, or committee of nutcases in the Pentagon decided, hey, that's a good idea, let's do it too.
Yeah.
And you know, we're Americans, and you know, we got lots of money and we can do it bigger and better than those Germans ever could think of, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, let's get a bunch of Germans over here to help us, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what they did, you know. If you wonder why our culture looks increasingly fascist, that's why.
Yeah.
We struck the deal with the devil.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And I mean, actually, just to, I know you're familiar and closer, you know Jim Mars, and you're familiar with his work. And his, one of my favorite books that he writes is the it basically goes back into ancient history and tracks these different families that have kind of been working, you know, behind both sides in a way as well. Like, we do have obviously the two sides, as you've been pointing out. We have the Anglo-American, and you got the, you know, German Nazi, you know, sort of origin. But then you sort of have the same sort of mentality behind all of these different dictatorships coming through history when you track it, and you can trace the bloodlines and all of that, and you see that maybe this has been the goal all along, is to rebuild what they lost a long time ago, to bring it back now. And they've had this deadline, because do you think it's possible they were aware of these cycles closing? Because, I mean, we have access to certain texts and certain information. They must have access to stuff that's locked up in some vault somewhere, right?
Well, I think it's a bit more complex than that. This is a phenomenon that I started writing about in the Giza Death Star Destroyed, and I write about it again in the book The Cosmic War. And that is that it's my, again, part of my assumption here, or part of my model that I use to look at these questions, that the cosmic war, the interplanetary war, if you will, that was fought, was so damaging to the infrastructure of whatever civilization waged it, that these surviving elites were confronted with one crucial problem right at the outset, and that was, how do we preserve all of the scientific knowledge against the inevitable decline that is going to occur, not only in knowledge but in technology, because of the loss of this infrastructure? How do we preserve it? And my answer was, you preserve it by creating a mythology whose means and elements, at first glance, do not appear scientific, but are communicable in such a way that the gain of noise over the information over time will not be all that significant. And that eventually, when science gets to a particular point of development, it can look at these myths and see that they are really encoded scientific information. Now, it's very interesting that this process began, this idea of looking at ancient myths and saying, hey, wait a minute, what these myths are saying are profoundly sophisticated in terms of their cosmology, in terms of their science. They're not just talking metaphysics, religion, or philosophy. Mm-hmm. That process really began during the Enlightenment. You find people like Thomas Jefferson writing about, why is it that these measures that come from ancient times appear to be geodetic and astronomically based? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, that's a whopper right there. Yeah. That's a dead giveaway, you know, right there.
Yeah.
It as science advances throughout the 19th century, you find an increase of curiosity about things like the Vedic literature, the Mahabharata, the Ramayana. As science continues, then of course the ones to get on the bandwagon in a major way are the Germans. You know, they start looking at these Mesopotamian texts and sending archaeological teams. You know, von Schliemann. Troy was a myth before von Schliemann read Homer and said, now wait a minute, and used Homer, which was, you know, academic in the box thinking at the time, said, no, it's all a myth, Troy didn't exist. Von Schliemann went out and found it.
Okay. Yeah, wow, yeah.
All right. Or Robert Koldewey, you know, going and finding Babylon and the Ishtar Gate and claiming even to have found the Hanging Gardens. All right. So in other words, you had this movement. As science increased, the willingness of academics to step outside of the academic box and look at these texts and say, now, wait a minute, these texts are showing us a real science. They're showing us a real physics. They're a metaphor of something that really once existed. And the only technical language capable of preserving this through time was the language of metaphysics and religion. All right? You look at Plato, particularly Plato, you're dealing with a man who comes right out and tells you virtually everything I write, I'm writing, number one, as an initiate, and number two, as an allegory.
Mm-hmm.
So when you read things like The Republic, most academics don't even realize you're reading a treatise on music theory.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And you are.
Yeah.
Okay. When you read his table of the turn from the images to the forms, and he tells you you've got to turn to I mathematici, to the mathematicals. What is he talking about? Why does he throw that term out there as being one of the universals you've got to turn to? What's he really saying?
Yeah.
Well, again, my point is you start looking at these texts with very, very different eyes once you assume that they might encode a very sophisticated cosmology and a very sophisticated science. So I call it in the Giza Death Star Destroyed and in the Cosmic War, I call this the unified intention of symbol. These myths were constructed deliberately with a multitude of levels, encoding a lot of information, and the more science advances, the more you uncode from these mythologies. Particularly in the Cosmic War, I spend a great deal of time, in that book and in the Giza Death Star Destroyed and in Grid of the Gods, looking at ancient texts and saying, all right, let's look at these things mathematically. What are they really telling us? Well, when you look at them that way...
Yeah, that's a totally different story.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, all sorts of interesting stuff starts to pop out of them.
So all this killing each other for thousands of years over whose religion's right is all for nothing, right?
Well, strange that you get that.
No, what I'm saying is that you're talking about these myths, right, and how they are encoding advanced information, and how people have been reading them in a literal topical sense only, and then fighting over the details, whereas we should all be looking at maybe different elements of, you know, one big advanced science.
I wrote a little book with a friend of mine, old friend of mine, by the name of Dr. Scott DeHart, and it's called Yahweh, the Two-Faced God. Hmm. Subtitle is Theology, Terrorism, and Topology. All right. Now, the basic theme, it's a little book that you can get at Lulu. The basic theme of the book is that what we call the three Yahwisms, because Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are inextricably tied to the character of Yahweh as it is quote unquote revealed in the first five books of Moses, all right? That's where all of this gets started, all right? Now, if you look at the sociological consequence of Yahwism, of revealed religion, what you really see is a revolution or revolt against that ancient philosophia perennis, against that ancient perennial philosophy that you see embodied in everything from the Tao in China to the Vedas to Buddhism to all the way to North America with the Native American populations here in South America, Egypt, Mesopotamia, Greece. They all have this same basic elemental cosmological system. And Yahwism comes along and says, no, all of that's wrong. So in other words, right there you have a sociological schism, because those religions must define themselves in opposition to something previously existing. Mm. They must have something to be opposed to.
Yeah, yeah.
So Egypt, you know, in the Bible, Egypt becomes the symbolism of this bloody revolution. And looked at that way, the founding of these religions is also an act of revolutionary violence, every bit as much as part of the structure as the Bolshevik Revolution in October of 1917. So, you know, we look at it from that point of view. Is the result of this to create endless division? I think so. Personally, if you look at what I think the core of this metaphor is, one of the things that pops out as an implication is that you no longer need a structure of revelation to have a structure of spirituality or religion or belief in God. Mm. And to say that to Western culture, or for that matter, to Islamic culture, is to say a blasphemy.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, this is the other thing that pops out as a consequence of looking at these ancient texts from the standpoint that they're a metaphor of a cosmology and of a science, and for that matter, of a religion, of a philosophy, all at once, and that it's a formally explicit metaphor. And I hope people catch what I'm saying there. Mm. If you look at the structure, let's look at two people just to show you what's been going on. Let's look at Moses, and let's look at George Adamski.
Wow, cool, okay, awesome. Okay.
Now, what does Moses do? All right, he goes up a mountain, there's thunder and lightning and lots of special effects, and he comes back down, his face is all aglow, he's carrying tablets, and he says, hey, I just met God, I got a message from God, here it is, okay? All right, yeah. Now, let's go to George Adamski. What's he do? Well, he goes, like Moses, he goes out to the desert, he brings a bunch of friends with him, he says, wait here, I'm going to go over the hill and have a conversation with a higher being. So he goes over the hill, he has a conversation with a higher being, and he comes back with what? A message. Okay. Now, my point here is you've got a structure implanted almost subconsciously within Western culture that religion or belief in a higher being means revelation, it means special message, chosen messengers, and immediately that puts society into the position of either belief or skeptic.
That's right.
And so the adherent of either of those systems of belief, be it Judaism with Moses, be it Islam with Muhammad, who, by the way, went to a mountain, went up the mountain, had a special revelation with a higher being, who told him a message to go carry to the people.
Same deal, yeah, same deal.
All on the road with Damascus, all right?
Yeah.
The same thing, George Adamski with his contact, all right? Odd, isn't it, that this is such a structure that it puts people hearing the message and puts the adherent of the message into the position of judging everybody else as either one of us or the enemy who must either be converted or shunned or killed or what have you. So in other words, the effect of the meme, the effect of the method, is sociologically divisive.
That's right.
It right there.
Yep.
Doesn't matter if it's Moses or George Adamski or anybody else claiming a contact. If they give you a message, then you're following the meme. Now, if you look at these ancient myths, what else do they always tell you? Well, there's a bunch of people around trying to scramble the information and scramble the process and divide humanity by whatever means, all right? So, you know, this is a very old game, and this is why I think it's so critically important for people, first of all, to start stepping out. Don't be afraid to step outside the box. And don't be afraid to ask the questions that your mind is telling you to ask. We've got to start trusting our mind. Absolutely.
Wow, that's really well put, and I totally resonate with that. It kind of reminds me, I recently reread The Gods of Eden by William Bramley, and he does a really good job of bringing all of those different elements in, religion and history and money and even the old, you know, ancient alien ideas and the whole thing. And for some reason, think he brought up George Adamski or something like that as well, initiating a very similar discussion where we're talking about the minute people start professing to you that they are the ones that have been given a message, or that they're, even in the academic world, they are the only ones who are properly informed to give you the message of truth.
Yes, right.
And instead of, when true spirituality is about understanding your own mind, like you said, and trying to constantly work on your own sort of Siddhartha road, if you will, or your own right. path to knowledge, and attaining your own enlightenment, and keeping that unique individuality. And it seems like whether it's a political structure, a religious structure, an educational structure, any other structure, we have the mm-hmm. same goal, which is, again, division. Because all I see when I walk around every day, you know, doing my stuff, I see nothing but divisions of one sort or another. It's, oh, it's right. a, you know, men versus women. There's always these big debates. There's, you know, this type of guy versus that type of guy. Or, you know, the whole media right. is just, you know, everything's UFC. Who, are you hot or not? Who, you know, who's the number one singing star? It's not anymore about self-discovery and organic processes right. and communication with human beings. And it's funny you brought up transhumanism, because I wanted to give you a little break here. And maybe get into that a little bit.
Sure.
And then if we could possibly in the second part also get into some of the cosmological stuff and the maybe more about the war. I wanted to ask about some detailed questions about the moon, Mars, some of your takes on that. I know you've done a lot of work with Richard Hoagland and others like that.
Right.
And then maybe get in, cover the UFO, ET subject a little bit. And then maybe see how we can tie this all together if that
sure.
sounds good for you.
All right.
Perfect. So do you want to, how long a break do you want there?
I'll just need a couple seconds.
Couple seconds? Okay.
Yep.
So what I'll do, I'll hang up just so we can reestablish another connection
okay.
after so it's
All
stronger.
Right.
We'll be back All in right. a couple minutes.
All right.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you, Joseph.
Mm-hmm.